Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange Homegrown Hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting. On the web at asmallorange.com. From WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech, technology worth talking about. We're here to make technology simple, easy, and approachable for you.
Got a question about your computer, smartphone, tablet, or the internet? Give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com.
So it is the fourth week in November, and the week that when here in the United States, we set aside one day to gather together with our friends and family and those we love to plot and devise schemes to get in front of the line at our favorite electronics and department stores so we can buy gadgets at cheap prices. And if necessary, climb over people's back to get a $5 toaster before the last one is gone. I'm, of course, talking about Black Friday.
Yes, that wonderful festive time of year when consumers bust down doors, clog up traffic, and trample their fellow shoppers in the name of consumerism. Thus the name, Black Friday. Ah, the joys of camping out in the parking lot Thanksgiving night so that you can get a cheap DVD player at 5 a.m.
Yeah, but this year, stores have really changed things up. Now, instead of opening at the wee hours of Friday morning, some stores like Walmart, Target, and Sears are opening on Thursday evening.
What?
And that has a lot of people upset, and rightfully so, I believe. Some Target and Walmart workers are threatening to strike on Thursday. We'll see how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Tom, some folks like to have a big turkey dinner on the Thursday before Black Friday in a sort of ritualistic preparation for the big event. And that's really going to crimp on a lot of people's plans. They might end up having to move the big dinner back to Wednesday just to have enough time.
You know, Ray, I thought you were just being sarcastic earlier. You do know that Thursday is Thanksgiving Day, and people just go shopping after Thanksgiving because a lot of folks have the day off, right? Thanksgiving is the actual holiday, not Black Friday.
Are you sure, Tom? I'm pretty sure folks just, you know, bake or fry a turkey for the preparation meal because they're so cheap this time of year. I don't think there's a holiday surrounding it. I mean, that sounds a little crazy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. You see, long before the United States was founded, the Pilgrims left England to seek out the New World on the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria back in September of 1620. They landed on November of 1620 and had some rough skirmishes with the Native Americans, but eventually the Native Americans helped the settlers work the land, and after the first harvest in the New World, the Pilgrims held the first Thanksgiving in 1621. The feast lasted 3 days, and 53 Pilgrims were in attendance. And 90 Native Americans attended.
Okay, Tom. Okay, I was just kidding.
Oh, sorry.
I wanted to let you hang out there and see how long it would last.
I could have gone on for a while.
All right. Well, yeah, of course, I'm just kidding. But, you know, it is sad to see more of this holiday creeping. You know, this Christmas is just moving forward. And I swear I saw Christmas decorations go up this year before Halloween decorations had even gone up. Yes, I finally got my laugh track.
Jeez. Anyway, on Black Friday, of course, we do usually see good deals on laptops, e-readers, cameras, and electronic storage, like external hard drives, SD cards, and USB flash drives. As always, though, don't let your common sense get lost in the frenzy. Not every doorbuster is actually a good deal. Stores tend to boost the price of the original price of an item so that the discount seems steeper than it actually is, Ray.
Right. For example, Best Buy, in their Black Friday sales, has a Lenovo 15.6-inch laptop with 2 gigs of RAM, 320-gig hard drive for $187.99. And according to the Best Buy website, this laptop is coming soon and will sell normally for $399.99, so a big discount.
Right.
But if you look at their website, the exact same laptop with 4 gigs of RAM is currently selling on the site for $299.99.
What?
So why would they, or really, how could they, sell the same laptop with less RAM for more money? That's just ridiculous. So really, this is just fluff to sell more laptops. It is a decent sale. I'm not saying that. But, you know, obviously they're not going to be able to sell the laptop for $399.99 normally. So it's not really a huge bargain, but it's a decent sale. Now, my wife Amber did some research for us and found these great deals this Thursday and Friday. Walmart, which is opening Thursday at 10 p.m., they have got an iPad 2 16GB for $3.99 with a $75 Walmart gift card.
Nice.
And something new this year, Walmart has three items: the iPad 2, a 32-inch HD TV, and a Blu-ray player, which are all guaranteed to be in stock from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m.
Guaranteed.
Now, so the first hour that they're open, yeah, that's
going to guarantee. How are they going to guarantee that?
Well, if the store runs out of inventory for these items, customers instead will purchase a guarantee card, and then the item will be shipped to the store for pickup in time for Christmas.
That's not bad.
So it's kind of a neat idea. There won't be any need to attack and assault your fellow customers on Black Thursday, I guess it'll be called, since they're opening Thursday. Let's see. Best Buy is opening Friday at midnight. They're going to have a Toshiba 40-inch television set with 1080p, 60Hz refresh rate, LCD, HDTV for only $179.99.
Nice.
So not a bad price.
Yeah.
Their normal price that they say they're normally going to sell it at is $419.99.
Okay.
So quite pretty steep discount.
What about Sears?
Sears, they are also opening Thursday at 8 p.m.
8 p.m.,
yep.
Wow.
They are going to have a couple of the really good items. They have the Nook Simple Touch for $39.99.
Okay.
That regularly sells for $99.99. Target's also going to have the Nook Simple Touch for $49. So cheaper at Sears if you're looking for a Nook Simple Touch. Target's also going to have the Nook Color, which is normally $139.99. They're going to have it for $99.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, if you're looking for a cheap tablet, it's not terrible.
Yeah.
But it's not great, but it's not terrible.
Great, but it's not terrible.
But for $99, it's a decent e-reader and a decent tablet. Now, if you're looking for a new SD card or USB flash drive or external hard drives, the deals are abundant. There's a ton of them.
Right. Walmart has a Toshiba 1TB portable hard drive for $59. Staples has a Seagate 2TB hard drive for $79.99. Best Buy has a Seagate Backup Plus 3TB with USB 3.0 for $99.99.
Yeah, and those are great deals. And actually, we're going to talk later on the show what you can do with those external hard drives. So if you're in the market for an external hard drive, those are great to check
yes,
out this,
absolutely.
This week. As far as SD cards, Walmart, Staples, and Radio Shack have an 8GB for about $5, $6 at Radio Shack, $5.99.
Okay.
A 16GB SD cards are at Walmart, Radio Shack, Staples, Office Depot, and Office Max for anywhere from the high $7 to the high $8.
Yeah.
For USB flash drives, there's 16 gigs at Best Buy, Staples, and Walmart for around $6. 32 gigs at Office Max, Radio Shack, and Best Buy for $10 to $13.
Wow.
And Office Max, Best Buy, and Office Depot have 64 gig USB flash drives for about $25 to $30. And we'll have that all broken down on our website, too. We'll include that information.
Yeah, those are really good deals. Now, your wife did this research. Where did she find all these great deals?
Well, it was all at a website, blackfriday.com. They kind of get a sneak peek of what the flyers are going to have on them.
Okay.
So they find out the information early. So,
all right, yeah, so check out blackfriday.com.
All right, we've got a voicemail, actually, about that Nook.
Hi, my name is Jerry from Jacksonville. My question today is about e-readers. I had a Kindle and I loved it, but it broke. So I was looking at a Nook because I saw them on sale. Should I make the switch? Is it worth it for the cheaper deal? Also, I don't have a lot of books that I would lose or anything, so I'm pretty much starting fresh. I'd love to have your insight on this. Thanks.
Now, last week we talked about the difference between e-readers and tablets,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't really break down the difference between e-readers. In my opinion, oh, and Jerry, thank you for your voicemail, by the way. In my opinion, after using both the Nook and the Kindle is a far superior device.
Really?
You know, Nooks have always felt like cheap toys, whereas Kindles, even though they're also made of plastic, they feel like well-engineered tools.
Hmm. Now, it's ironic that you say that, Ray, because the whole reason why Jerry called us is because her Kindle broke. And didn't you break your Kindle as well?
You know what, Tom? You're right. That's true. And I thought about last night, out of the 7 people, including my wife, that I know who have gotten a Kindle, 5 out of the 7 have broken.
Whoops.
So that's, you know, of course, that's completely anecdotal evidence. And I don't, but I also don't know anyone who's bought a Nook either. So it might just be an e-reader thing. It might just be a universal thing for e-readers.
Mm-hmm.
E-readers are just so convenient and so portable that they end up getting sat on or dropped on the concrete, and they're still pretty fragile. So no matter what brand you get, of course, make sure you get a good case.
Yes, absolutely.
So anyway, let's take a look and compare them apples to apples, so to speak.
Or e-readers to e-readers.
Or e-readers to e-readers, right.
Because Apple doesn't make an e-reader.
That's true. Okay, so there are two main categories with e-readers, lit and unlit. In the unlit category, Amazon has the $69 Kindle, and Barnes & Noble has the Nook Simple Touch for $99. The Simple Touch is $30 more, but it has a touch screen, whereas the Kindle only has a five-way controller. Typing on either one is not an enjoyable experience, but it's certainly easier to set up the Nook Simple Touch than it is the $69 Kindle. But that's something you only have to do once, so is it really worth the extra $30? The Nook doesn't have ads, but the $69 Kindle does have ads. But you can pay an extra $20 to have the ads removed from the Kindle and still save $10 off the normal price. Now, the Simple Touch claims to have the longest battery life at over 2 months, whereas the Kindle is rated at 2 months. So I'm not sure there's much of a difference there. I mean, when you're looking at battery life at or near or over 2 months, are you really going to notice the difference of that extra few days? The Nook is slightly thicker and wider than the Kindle. Not a lot, but it's enough to notice.
Especially if you're holding it for hours on end reading.
Exactly. And also, the page turns are somewhat slower on the Nook than on the Kindle. It might not make a difference at first, but after a while, it's going to get really annoying. Also, the text on the Kindle is sharper than on the Nook. And it seems like the screen is thinner because the text looks like it's closer to the surface.
Okay.
Whereas the Nook feels like you're looking through through glass or through the plastic. It's further below the surface. Just kind of a little thing that annoys me. Now, as far as selection goes, Barnes & Noble claims to have over 2.5 million titles. Amazon claims to have only 1 million. So you got a little advantage on the Nook. Now, in the lit category, e-readers with lights built in, Amazon has the Kindle Paperwhite at $119 or $139 with the special offers. Barnes & Noble has the Nook Simple Touch with glow light. Now, I have played with both of them, and I definitely prefer the Paperwhite over the Simple Touch with glow light. Glow light is really an appropriate term because it definitely glows. There is a lot more ambient light with the glow light than the Paperwhite. Somehow the light comes in from the sides, and with the Paperwhite, it really shines down on the screen.
Right.
So it's hard to explain the technology behind it, but you can definitely notice a difference. Now, going back to your original question, $39 or even $49 is a great deal for the Nook Simple Touch because they normally run for $99. But personally, I would rather buy the $69 Kindle. But honestly, I'm not sure if that's just my personal bias or not. But right now, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got more of your questions. This is Deemable Tech. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Ray Hollister, joined, of course, by my co-host, Tom Braun. Actually, before we jump into our next question, I wanted to kind of wrap up Jerry's question. And like I was saying, I'm not sure if it's just my personal bias as far as the Nook versus the Kindle. You know, if you're not heavily invested in the Amazon ecosphere, Jerry, and you haven't bought a bunch of ebooks on Amazon, and you're comfortable with the Simple Touch, then maybe you should get it. But personally, I feel that the Kindle is just worth the extra money. So for me, it's not worth the savings. I feel like the Simple Touch should normally be priced at $49. I kind of feel like it's a ripoff at $99, to be honest. Again, that's just my opinion. But and honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if it stays at $49 either immediately after the sale or, you know, a few weeks after the sale. So
yeah, it does feel like, you know, once you go down to that price, they're not going to jack it back up to $99.
Right. Yeah, and it doesn't seem like a big surprise, especially with two different stores having it at two different prices. They're mm-hmm. probably just kind of testing the waters to see mm-hmm. how much they can bring it down. I would love to see a popular e-reader at below $50. I think that'd be a great.
That'd be great.
It'd
yeah.
be a good thing for e-readers. Well, let's see. Just in time for the holiday season, we have a brand new debunkable. Well, it's not brand new, of course. No internet rumor ever really is it, Tom?
No, there's not, Ray.
Well, debunkable, for those that don't know, is the part of the show where we take the craziest, funniest, or most interesting rumors and urban legends that we find on Facebook, Twitter, or in our email box, and we dig into the story behind them and find out if they are true or bunk.
Yeah, like Ray mentioned, this week's debunkable comes from the world of retail. The email reads, "Pay attention to your receipts. This is important." And I'm reading this in this voice because this is all in bold, all caps.
All caps.
"With the Christmas season coming up, this is really important. Please pass this along. 5!" "Check your receipts before leaving any cashier's station. 5!" "This could happen anywhere." It happened at a Walmart in Houston, Texas. "I bought a bunch of stuff, over $150, and I glanced at my receipt as the cashier was handing me the bags. I saw a cashback of $40. I told her I didn't request a cashback and to delete it. She said I'd have to take the $40 because she couldn't delete it. I told her to call a supervisor. The supervisor came and said I'd have to take it. I said no! Taking the $40 would be a cash advance against my Discover, and I wasn't paying interest on a cash advance. If they couldn't delete it, and they would have to delete the whole order."
Oh.
So the supervisor had the cashier delete the whole order and rescan everything. The second time I looked at the electronic pad before I signed, and a cashback of $20 popped up. What? At that point, I told the cashier, and she deleted it. Total came out right. The cashier agreed that the electronic pad must be defective. Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
Obviously, the cashier knew the electronic pad wasn't defective because she never offered me the $40 at the beginning. The email goes on to talk about other people that this has happened to, and other stores where it has happened at. Now, Ray, you worked in the retail industry for quite a while, so what's the story here? Is this true or just bunk?
Well, it's true. Yeah, I did work in retail for quite a few years, in addition to all the other plethora of things I've done in my life. But it has been about 8 years since the last time I worked in retail, so this one caught me off guard. I knew that based on how things worked back when I was a cashier, this couldn't actually happen, but I assume that things must have changed over the years.
Sure.
So I looked into it, and it turns out, like the song says, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
What song is that?
Actually, there's two that I know of, one by Bon Jovi and the other by Cinderella. They're a hair band from the 80s. The phrase is actually a French proverb that was first written by French novelist Alphonse Carr.
That's great, Ray.
Okay, well, anyway, back to my point. Things haven't changed that much in the last 8 years.
How so?
Well, cashiers can't initiate a cash back request from a debit or credit card. The only place on the cash register where you can request to have cash back from the transaction is at the PIN pad that the customer uses. The customer has to request it, and the customer has to pick the specific amount, and the customer has to confirm the total.
Really?
So the cashier can't do any of that. If you were to, you know, ask the cashier to give you $40 cash back, they would tell you to press the button requesting cash back because there's nothing they can do to make it happen.
So there's absolutely no way they can initiate the cash back sequence.
No, not at all. Like, they have no control over that at all. The only thing that they get is a prompt that says, give them money. Now, what can happen, and I've seen this happen a lot in my experience, is that, you know, some customers don't really read the prompts, mm-hmm. and they just press the button they think they're supposed to press. And also, sometimes in customers' defense, the buttons, because I guess our customers are listening, so maybe I should be nice. The buttons are close together, and the on-screen prompts can be confusing also. Extremely rarely, the PIN pad itself can have a mechanical or a digital problem where you press one thing and another activates, mm-hmm. kind of like the voting, the touch screens during the election. But it's almost always user error.
Okay.
Now, occasionally, sure, a cashier might forget to give you your cash back, especially if you don't mention it.
Mm-hmm.
But cashiers aren't plotting against you and initiating cash backs and slipping the money into their pockets after you leave. Not even a small number of them are doing this. And I can say that with complete certainty. Because one thing that has changed in retail over the last couple of decades is that almost every major retailer has video cameras installed over every single cash register.
That's right.
And those video cameras are being constantly monitored by loss prevention staff at every store. So if a cashier was slipping money into their pockets, it would be noticed quickly, and they would be being escorted out of the store in a fashionable matching pair of steel bracelets. Hmm.
Well, there's another debunked urban myth. Even if cashiers wanted to, they couldn't take cash out of your credit card and hope you wouldn't notice. If you get an email forwarded to you that is shocking or just seems a little suspicious, email us at debunkable@debunkable.com. Debunkable@debunkable.com. We'll look into it and report about it on the show.
Yeah, and we would especially like to find a crazy one that is actually true.
That's right.
So far, all of our debunkable myths we've done have been false. So if you know a crazy one that is real, make sure to send it to us. That's debunkable@deemable.com. Or if you forget that one, you can send it to us at questions@deemable.com and we'll still get it.
That's right.
So, all right, we got another email from Erica. Tom, can you grab that one?
Sure. She writes, I have a bunch of pictures and videos of my kids and my family that I don't want to delete, but I don't really want to keep them on my hard drive. They're not pictures or videos that I want to look at all the time, but I definitely want to have them down the road. What's the best way for me to archive them? Should I put them on CDs or DVDs? If so, what's the lifespan of those? In the old days, my mom just put the pictures in a shoebox, and although they didn't last forever, they would be there in 10 or 20 years, even if they weren't in perfect condition. Now it seems like digital pictures disappear every 5 years when your hard drive crashes. How can I hang on to pictures of my kids so I can show their grandkids and embarrass them like my mom did to me?
Thanks for your question, Erica. You know, this is a serious topic that I don't think anyone in the tech industry has paid enough attention to.
I agree.
And I say it's a serious topic because I seriously got a lot of heat from my wife when we pretty much lost every picture and video from my daughter's childhood. But here's the thing. I was doing things right. I was backing up our data frequently, and I still managed to lose everything. So what should we do to prevent this from happening?
Well, the first thing you have to realize, I think, is that there's no way to prevent all data loss. No matter what you do, no matter how perfect your backup system is, there's still a chance for you to lose everything. I say that not to make you paranoid, but to give you some freedom so you can relax a little. There's no magic pill that will take care of this. Even if you were still saving all your photos in a shoebox like your mother did, you could still lose everything in a fire or something, you know?
Yeah, and that's right. So I don't know if that'll help you relax or maybe make you more anxious, but hopefully it'll allow you to take action with some confidence and a little bit of urgency.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, here's what you need to do to protect your digital archive. There are three questions. We answer a question by saying you have three questions. You have three questions that you need to know the answer to. But once you know the answer to those questions, you can rest confidently that you've done everything you can to protect your archive.
Now, so what are these questions?
The first one is, what would you do if you accidentally deleted something important or your computer crashed?
Okay.
The second question is, what would you do if there was a fire, tornado, hurricane, flood, etc., some disaster?
Mm-hmm.
And the third question is, what would you do if your backup failed?
Okay.
So for the first question, what would you do if you accidentally deleted something important or your computer crashed? You need to have a daily backup plan set up that you have quick and easy access to. The most convenient way to do this is to buy an external hard drive, like
right.
We were talking about before, some great deals this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You need one that has the same amount of hard drive space as your computer, or the same amount of hard drive space as all the computers in your house. No more, no less.
Hmm.
And here's why. This is not a place to move your files to when you run out of space on your computer.
Hmm.
The only thing that should be on this external hard drive is a backup of your computer's files. It is very tempting to move your old shoebox files to an external hard drive to free up room on your computer. Now, and we'll talk about this more, but if you run out of room on your computer and you need more space, you should either upgrade your internal hard drive or you need to get another separate external hard drive for that. And you need to make sure that your backup external hard drive has enough space for the extra external hard drive as well.
So you're backing up your external hard drive to an external hard drive, just to be clear.
Yes.
Okay.
We'll talk more about that in a minute. Now that you have an external hard drive for a backup, you need to make sure that your backup system does so automatically. It happens without even thinking about it. if you try to remember to back up your files every day, you're never going to do with no consistency. Now, there's a program called CrashPlan that works on Windows, Mac, even Linux, and Solaris.
That's great, because I don't know what Solaris is.
Yeah, operating system is a that's an operating system that no one uses. But it is used, actually, in businesses.
Okay.
Install CrashPlan on your computer and set it up to automatically back up your files to that external hard drive at least once a day. Once you have your backup set up and running, if you accidentally delete a file or your computer crashes, you can restore the file with CrashPlan software.
Now, for the second question, what would you do if there was a fire, tornado, hurricane, or flood, etc.? Ideally, you could grab your external hard drive as you run out the door to evacuate.
Right.
But realistically, life doesn't always work that way. You might want to grab a pet instead, or a child.
Or your prescriptions, or something like that.
So with that in mind, in addition to a local backup, you should have a remote backup, either in the cloud or at a friend or family member's house. With CloudPlan Plus, you can pay some amount of dollars per year to back up data to your servers, or you can set it up to back up to an external hard drive at someone else's house. So either cough up the cash to pay for the cloud storage, or pick up an external hard drive and give it to your cousin Jack that lives on the other side of the country when he comes to visit for Christmas. Ideally, this would be someone who lives far enough away that they would not be impacted by the same weather or catastrophic event that you are.
Right.
It wouldn't help if you set it up at your mom's place and she lives in the same neighborhood as you.
Yeah, because the hurricane's probably going to hit her too.
Yeah,
or the earthquake or whatever.
Yeah, it only rained at your house.
Exactly.
It wouldn't. So if you don't manage to salvage your local backup after the storm, call your cousin Jack, ask him to email you the hard drive, or just restore the files from his hard drive or the cloud storage over the internet.
Right. Now, and finally, the last question, what would you do if your backup fails? Well, this question is exactly why having one backup plan is not good enough. Here's why. Let's say your house gets hit by lightning. It was really bad and it destroyed your computer. Fortunately, you have a backup of all your files on an external hard drive. So, you buy a new computer, you bring it home, you set it up, you plug in your external hard drive, but that's when you find out your external hard drive was toast also. Mm. Now you're out of luck. Well, okay, let's look at the same situation. But this time you have a backup at your cousin Jack's house.
I love cousin Jack.
Yeah, Jack's great. Now, you call up your cousin and he tells you, oh, sorry, cuz, my cat knocked it off the desk and it was destroyed. I forgot you were backing up to it. Well, now you're in trouble again.
Okay, so obviously the solution is just to use a backup like CrashPlan Plus or Carbonite then, right, Ray?
No.
No.
Let's go back to the same situation one more time. But this time, let's say Erica has an online backup service. But when she goes to restore the backup, the files are corrupt. She's still out of luck.
Oh, gosh.
So here's what you need to do. You should have any files that are valuable to you backed up at least two locations. And that doesn't include the original file. So the original file and two backups.
Okay.
And really precious files like, you know, childhood memories should be backed up to at least three or more locations. So I would have a local backup on an external hard drive, a remote backup at cousin Jack's place, and a cloud backup on something like CrashPlan Plus or Carbonite.
Okay, but you're starting to talk about a good bit of money now, Ray. What if I can't afford to do all of that right now? What would you say I should start with?
Well, if I was on a tight budget, which, let's be honest, I am, the first thing I would do is get an online backup like Carbonite or CrashPlan Plus. It's definitely the most secure as far as loss prevention goes. Their servers are in really secure, climate-controlled server farms, and they're constantly backed up. So it's a lot less likely to have a problem than an external hard drive sitting on your desk. It is slower to set up, though. It takes a longer time for the first few, the first initial backup. It can take a few hours to several days, but it's definitely the safest place for the price.
Okay.
Something neat with a CrashPlan Plus, you can also, they'll send you a hard drive in the mail. You can back up then and then mail it back to them. So
That's cool.
It costs a little bit of money. It's about $120 to do that. But actually, what's really cool, for the military, you get it for free.
Oh, wow.
I thought that was really awesome.
That's nice.
So, you know, I would do that first. Then when I had a little extra cash, I would buy that external hard drive for my local backup. And then later I would get that other external hard drive for my remote backup at my cousin Jack's place.
All right. Well, I just realized that although this is really good information, we actually went on kind of a tangent that wasn't directly answering Erica's question. Erica said she had files that she didn't want to keep on her hard drive, but she didn't want to delete them either.
No, actually, we did cover that. What she needs to do is get an external hard drive just to store those kinds of things on. Let's call that one an archive hard drive.
Okay.
It rhymes. Look at that. Archive hard drive. And she needs to make sure that she backs that up regularly also.
Okay.
So also these files are probably those precious files that I talked about. I would also back them up to a burnable CD, DVD as well, something like that, and store those someplace safe and dry.
Mm-hmm.
But don't just leave them there, and don't delete them from your hard drive just because you have them burnt on a CD or DVD. Writable DVDs and CDs are starting to get a bad reputation for falling apart after, or for failing after a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So keep them on your archive hard drive and check the DVDs or CDs every year or so. If they're corrupt, throw them away and burn a new disk from the files that you have saved on your archive hard drive.
Archive hard drive.
And and the reason why is because those individually can fail. The CDs mm-hmm. can fail. The archive hard drive can fail. And that's why it's so important that you back it up and keep mm-hmm. that backup going. So unfortunately, it's not something you can just, you know, carve it in stone and it stays there forever. With digital information, mm-hmm. you got to kind of keep them updated. But the nice part about it is if you do that, you'll have a perfect copy saved. Whereas, you know, with the old Polaroids, once mm-hmm. they're worn out and they're gone. That's you true. Can't save them.
That's true. Although, you know, if you did carve it in stone, that would last for, you know, millennia. So that's an option. If you have a large stone slab outside your house and a lot of spare time, you can just start carving ones and zeros into it.
Sure. But yeah, it would be kind of interesting to carve something digital into a rock.
Oh. Now you've got the wheels in my brain turning. I bet there's someone out there doing that. But we are really getting off on a tangent.
Yes, we are off on a tangent. So going back to your question, Erica, what I would do, like I say, is get an external hard drive just for your archive of things and then make sure that mm-hmm. is part of your backup plan, that you are keeping that backed up in mm-hmm. all of them.
And you're making a clear differentiation between the external hard drive I use for nightly backups and the external right. hard drive I use for extra space.
Right. And that's the thing. I might suggest getting a smaller hard drive for that.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe like a 500 gigabyte.
Yeah. You probably don't need 3 terabytes for extra
right.
space.
And that, you know, I mean literally a physically smaller one, like one of those pocket ones. That way, you know, it's easier to differentiate. Okay, this is my backup. Mm-hmm. This is my archive hard drive.
And label them. Just print out a label and stick it on there.
Yeah. And that way you do it. And then, like I said, but it's so important that you actually back up those files, because if you don't back up those files, that's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
We were backing things up and my computer crashed. So we just went and started to put the archive back on the hard drive, and turns out the hard drive was dead. So we were out of luck. And
wow.
It is rough. We lost like 5 years of memories that
stinks.
We're never going to get back. So, but if you do that, and like I said, make sure, go ahead and make an extra copy of those things and put them on a DVD or a CD.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And that's a great extra resource you can use. So if you do all that, you'll definitely have a very small chance of losing your data. It could still happen, but you should still be able to sleep comfortably at night. Well, we've got to take another quick break. When we come back, we got more of your questions. This is Deemable Tech.
Welcome back to Deemable Tech. I'm Tom Braun, joined, of course, by my co-host, Ray Halster.
All right, we got an email from Brandon. Brandon writes, how much more secure is a wired internet connection versus a wireless connection?
Okay, Brandon. Well, there are basically two ways to get your computer online, which, as Greg, you've pointed out, are wired and wireless. Wireless, of course, means your computer's not physically plugged into anything. Wired means you literally have one of those Cat 5 cables that looks like a thick blue phone line plugged into your computer. Now realize there are several different types of connections, which we call wireless. You have good old-fashioned Wi-Fi, which is the type of your router at home broadcasts with, but you also could be talking about 3G or 4G connection through your cellular service.
Okay, so, but out of those, which would you say would be the most secure?
Well, that would definitely be a wired connection. There's really no way for someone to intercept that signal without physically cutting into the cable and splicing in.
Okay.
But honestly, you can never assume that you are absolutely secure. Just because someone isn't intercepting your signal doesn't mean they don't have other means of compromising your security.
Are you about to pull out the tinfoil hat?
I'm not trying to make listeners paranoid here. I just don't want anyone to assume that simply because you're plugged into a hard line that you cannot be hacked. That's just not true. Mm. But you're certainly safer than on a wireless connection. Now, if you are on a wireless connection, it's definitely easier for someone nearby to intercept your signal.
Okay, so, and again, you're talking about Wi-Fi there, but what about like on a 3G or 4G connection? How secure is that?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that a cellular connection is pretty secure. It's going to be at least as secure as an ordinary cell phone call.
Hmm.
It uses the same technology. Now, we all know that there are ways of hacking those, but if a white van is following you around with advanced cellular signal breaking equipment, you probably have bigger problems. Or you're on an episode of Person of Interest.
Oh, that's true, yeah. I've always wanted to be on TV.
Yeah. So if you've seen Jim Caviezel following you around, watch out.
Now, for ordinary Wi-Fi, you have secured and unsecured connection. A secured Wi-Fi connection is one where you have to enter a password to log in. And there are several flavors of Wi-Fi passwords, WEP, WPA, but the only one you need to remember is WPA2. Now, if your router doesn't have that, just use WPA. So make sure that when you're setting up your home router that you do turn on WPA2 and set a password.
Yes.
Or if you already have your Wi-Fi set up, go into your router settings and add a WPA2 password.
Absolutely. You also have open Wi-Fi connections.
No, that you're talking about like at Starbucks or, mm-hmm. or McDonald's.
Right. Now, let me be very clear. An open Wi-Fi connection is absolutely unsecure.
Mm.
There are readily available programs that allow people to steal your login and password to Facebook, to Gmail, to other sites if you access them over an open Wi-Fi connection. So I would be really leery of open Wi-Fi, especially if you're doing confidential business stuff. Make sure if you're in a coffee shop using their Wi-Fi that it requires a password to connect. Otherwise, you are leaving yourself wide open.
Now, there is a new app which we're going to check out, and we're probably going to talk about it on next week's episode, that sets up a VPN, a virtual private network.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you're going across an unsecure network, you're going across with a secure channel through it. It's really wild. It's not crazy. I mean, techies have been doing it for years, but this is mm-hmm. one that you can do on your Android phone and your iPhone and your laptop, and it's super secure. So we're going to talk about it next week.
Right. Yeah.
But in general, yeah, open Wi-Fi is completely mm-hmm. unsecure, and it's really easy to hack. Like, anybody can do that.
Yeah, anyone can do it. Now,
I'm sorry.
Okay, I was going to say, even secured wireless networks can be broken. So if you're doing something that requires a high degree of security, I would stay off public Wi-Fi in general, whether passworded or not.
Yeah. So in general, it sounds like we've broken it down to wired is definitely the most secure,
mm-hmm.
Ethernet, LAN connection wired in. Then cellular or 3G or 4G connection is the next secure. Then secured Wi-Fi on WPA2
mm-hmm.
is next. And then, of course, unsecured Wi-Fi is the absolute worst. But you're never really totally secure, regardless of what type of connection you use.
Exactly. And that's your daily dose of paranoia brought to you by Deemable Tech.
All right. So there you go, Brandon. Let's see. We got another email from John. John writes, actually, can you grab this one?
Yeah, sure. I need some help. I have kept someone's business card since I finally threw out my Rolodex a few years ago. Now I just enter all the information in my Outlook contacts instead. It's nicer because I can sync it up with my phone and they're all organized. But the problem is that typing them up is a pain. Every time I come back from a conference, I have 10 to 20 business cards and I dread sitting down to input them all. In the 21st century, there must be a better way. What do you guys recommend? Is there an app I can use to scan a business card into my iPhone? Is there a gadget that will do it? I don't want to spend a lot, but I'd be willing to spend up to $50 if it worked well and made life a lot easier. Thanks.
Oh, thanks for your email, John. Yeah, that is it is really depressing. I thought that by now we would have some sort of replacement for business cards.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems, at least for the time being, that the best way to pass contact information is still on a little hard piece of cardboard paper.
Yeah, killing trees.
Yep. You know, and I thought that something like Bump would come along. Bump is the app that's on iPhone and Android that you can use to transfer contact information. I thought that it was going to come along and it would be so successful that it would just replace business cards as the common way of exchanging information. But the problem is that it has to be so easy that everyone can do it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with Bump and every other attempt at creating an electronic business card is that nobody wants to take the time to set up their business card because they can't use it unless the other person that they're meeting already knows how to use that system.
Yep.
Because, I mean, I've tried. I was like, oh, you got Bump? No, I don't have Bump. Okay, well, never mind. Here, I'll just send it to you. And actually, right now, anyone with a smartphone can already send their contact information in their phone to someone else electronically via a text message.
Right.
But nobody knows how to do that. I did it one time, and someone was like, why'd you send me this information? I don't know what this is. Like, just click on it, and it turns it, whatever, never mind. And that means, at least for the time being, that we will still have to enter everyone's contact information into our devices manually.
Okay. So is there any app out there that can help with that, as our listener asks?
Well, there are a couple of apps. ABBY's business card reader, which is available for both the Android and the iPhone. It's $9.99 on the Android and $4.99 on the iPhone.
That doesn't seem fair.
It is my personal choice. I like it a lot. It's the same company that makes TextGrabber, which I was raving about recently.
Okay.
The optical character recognition text app that I was talking about on the show. It is perfectly, instantly accurate. It is really great. All of the OCR work, the optical character recognition work, is done on the phone, so there's no waiting for a response from a server, and it's definitely worth the $4.99 on the iPhone.
Okay.
We did notice, though, that there were reviews on the Android one that were a little sketchy. Perhaps, you know, we should wait until they come out with a version on Android, a new version on Android first.
And full disclosure, I'm too much of a cheapskate to spend $9.99 to check it out myself.
Fair enough. Now, be careful. There is a pro version of ABBY's business card reader. That's a very steep. It's $69.99, but it supports multiple languages and it integrates with Salesforce CRM customer relations management software. So you're familiar with that, it's definitely worth $70, but for most people it's not.
Now, a free app that we found that was very nice was the Yolu card free on Android, iPhone, and Windows Phone 7. And that's Y-O-L-U.
Mm-hmm.
Yolu prides itself on being 100% accurate. They say, if your name card is not scanning and 100% accurate, then it's just not good enough. In our test with our Androids and our iPhones, it was 100% accurate to a fault.
Yep.
It even included the printed on recycled paper in the contact's mailing address.
Yeah. In fairness, so did ABBY.
Yeah.
YY's.
Because they don't know.
Yeah.
Yolu has a neat electronic business card exchange that you can use if you know the other person also has Yolu, which kind of goes back to the earlier thing where they probably won't.
Which means you'll never use it.
Right. But it's a nice idea. Scans are sent to a cloud server where it is being transcribed.
Yeah. And see, that kind of concerned me.
Mm-hmm.
It's being transcribed by who or what? Was it being transcribed by software or people chained to a desk?
Yeah, I like to think it's a little Korean somewhere.
Yeah, oh, well, I mean, and
I don't know.
It kind of worries me. I think, you know, the information's actually being transmitted to China.
Mm-hmm.
That's not just being paranoid. The website is kind of odd, and the company's name does include Beijing in the name of it. So.
Yeah, they definitely seem like an Asian company, but the software, fact of the matter is, it worked well, and it was free.
And it was free. Now, a couple of honorable mentions. There's Card Munch, which is only on the iPhone. It's also free. It's owned by the same company that owns LinkedIn. It works just like Yolu. It scans to the cloud server or possibly two people chained to a desk. I'm not sure. It is 100% accurate. It's actually more accurate than Yolu. It did not add the recycled paper line. And it also lets you connect to your LinkedIn page. So
nice.
That's kind of nice. There's also Camcard BCR, a business card reader. There's an Android and an iPhone version. There's a Lite version that's free, lets you scan up to 20 business cards a month. There's a Pro version for $4.99. That one also works pretty well. You did ask about gadgets. There are a few gadgets that'll do the job. Unfortunately, none that we could find that would do the job well anywhere near $50. The problem is there's a lot of scanners out there, But the problem is the software.
Mm-hmm.
The best scanner in the world is just useless if it doesn't have good software that knows what to do with the image after it's scanned.
Right.
The best ones we could find are the Neat Desk Scanner and the Dymo Card Scan.
Okay.
Both of these devices sit on your desk and plug into your computer via the USB port. Both of them include software that automatically detects the contact information on the business card and saves them as a new contact, and they both synchronize with Outlook. So when you sync your iPhone with your Outlook contacts, you'll have them on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
The Neat Desk Scanner is not a dedicated device that just scans business cards. It's a whole office digitizing, organizing gadget.
Wow.
The device and the software that comes with it are both designed to allow you to scan in any paper document you receive,
mm-hmm.
whether it's an envelope or business cards, letters, legal documents. So you turn it all into a digital archive.
The software detects what
kind of document it is. Because it actually has different slots that you put the paper in.
Oh, okay.
And it figures out what it is, takes the information, and sorts it accordingly.
Huh.
And it works really great for what it's designed for. I mean, it can totally digitize your entire office. But if your budget's $50, it's way out of your budget. It runs at $399.95.
Okay.
So yeah. It ain't cheap. But if you're looking for a whole office document scanner, you might want to consider this one. It's actually really awesome.
Okay.
The other one, the Dymo Card Scan Personal, does one thing and only does one thing, but it does it very well. And that, of course, is scanning business cards.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's not a whole lot cheaper at $159.99.
And, so, I mean, if you can get an app on your phone for $10,
yeah,
why would you not?
Yeah, I mean, between those choices, I definitely went with the ABBY's or Abby's business card reader because it works perfectly. It saves me a lot of time. There's even, we found out last night that Google Goggles, you can technically use Google Goggles on Android or iPhone, and it'll scan in business cards.
It's free, but it's not 100% accurate.
Yeah, and it's server-based, so
it's
not
that great. It's probably not some Korean chain to a desk. I'll say
yeah, that's true. It's all software.
Yeah.
So it's fun to play with, but I wouldn't trust it to do all my... So.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we got another question here from Sasha. She writes, I need help. I changed my iPhone password and I can't log into it. If it helps, my iPhone is not jailbreaked and it's on Sprint running iOS 6.0. Thanks for the help.
Oh, okay. Well, I got bad news. There used to be a couple of easy tricks you could do, but Apple fixed those several versions of iOS ago.
Mm.
You used to be able to make an emergency phone call to 911 or 999 or 112 or whatever it is in your country, and there was a trick where you could get it to unlock that way. There was also a program called iExplorer that you could use on your computer to delete the file that stores the passcode and it would be unlocked. iExplorer is still around. It's a great program, but Apple fixed that vulnerability.
Mm.
So now there's really only one way to get rid of a passcode that you've forgotten, and that's doing a hard restore, or a DFU, a device firmware upgrade restore, as it's called, of your iPhone. It's not terribly hard, but it's not super easy either. And I just found out before the show, actually, that it looks like my daughter has locked us out of our iPad, so I'm going to be doing this when I get home. Here's what you do. First, you need to sync your iPhone with your computer, which you can do even with the phone locked or the iPad locked.
Okay.
So that you won't lose your data. After that's done, you're going to leave your iPhone plugged in and reboot it by holding down the home button and the power button for a little bit over 10 seconds. Then, once you see the Apple logo, keep holding down the home button, but let go of the power button. You'll then see a USB cable on the screen and a message saying connect to iTunes. Then, you'll see that iTunes on your computer has detected an iPhone in recovery mode. Click the restore button on the screen, and then let your computer do its thing. Once it's done, you'll have your iPhone back, restored with all your data, and you won't have a passcode anymore.
Okay.
So that takes care of it. Like I said, it's not that easy, but it's not super hard. And I'll include a link to an article from Lifehacker that also goes into full details on
now, that. Is that going to set you back to basically factory default? Are you going to have to reinstall all your apps?
No, all your apps will come right back.
Okay.
Everything goes back the way you had it, but no passcode.
Okay.
So it kind of works conveniently.
That's pretty good then.
Well, we got an email from Carson. You want to grab that one?
Sure. He says, usually when I need to share a file with a friend, I just email it to them. But the other day I had a video file I wanted to share, and it was too big to email. I thought of putting it on my thumb drive, but then I couldn't find the darn thing. I wound up burning the file onto a CD, but that was slow and seemed like a waste of a good CD. Do you guys have any ideas about easier ways to share large files?
Yes.
Lots?
Tons.
Oodles.
Whole bunch? I've run out of synonyms. The point is, there are numerous...
Or myriad.
Ooh, nice. Ways to share files now. The best way to do it depends on how big the file is. Is it small? Is it large? Is it huge?
Well, wait, maybe we should explain what file sizes are really big and what are just extra medium.
Okay, well, good idea. Well, most email services will let you send files up to 5 megabytes in size without complaining. So let's assume that your file is bigger than 5 megs. I'd say 5 to 50 megabytes is medium size. 50 megabytes to a gigabyte, which is 1,000 megs, or actually 1024 megs,
technically,
is large. And anything over a gigabyte is pretty big. If you're talking 20 plus gigabytes, you're getting into enormous territory, and you may have to spend some money on getting something like a portable hard drive or buying space on a file locker service.
And we mentioned the external hard drives earlier that you can, of course, pick up.
But anything short of that, you can probably manage for free. Tom, why don't we quickly run down our top five?
Works for me. Shall I start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Carson. You said you couldn't find your thumb drive, but you may well have an even bigger and better piece of portable storage in your pocket at this moment. Your phone. If you've got a smartphone, whether it's an iPhone or an Android phone of some kind, like a Droid or a Samsung Galaxy S3, you've got at least 8 gigabytes of storage space just sitting there in your pocket, and you can absolutely put pretty much any kind of file you can think of on there. If you've got an Android-based phone, this is usually just as simple as connecting your phone to whatever computer you're using. Once there, it should show up just like a thumb drive would, and you can drag and drop files onto the folder like normal.
Now, if you've got an iPhone, you'll need to do this through iTunes. Plug the phone in, open up iTunes, you'll see your iPhone listed under devices, the computer recognizes. Click on your phone in iTunes, click the apps tab at the top, scroll down the list to the bottom that shows a section that says file transfers with a list of apps, and you can drag the file to an empty space to the right of the app you want to transfer to. Or you can click add to browse for a file to choose it.
Okay, yeah. And let's not forget there are other devices which can serve the same purpose. You got an e-reader, a tablet. These things also have basically portable hard drives inside them. You can stick files on them of any kind and connect them to different computers. Any of those can handle large files.
Right, and all you have to do is make sure that you have the cable to connect them.
Yes.
Like Tom said, it's always handy to carry a spare USB. Actually, you didn't say that. I don't know why I said that. But carry a spare cable with you.
Yeah, I always do like to carry a spare.
Yeah. Well...
Now, if you have to send it long distance, you might need to look into some cloud-based services, such as, Dropbox or Google Drive or even Microsoft's SkyDrive. And we've talked about those before. Maybe we can go into some more detail on how to do this next week.
Yep. But, of course, you may want to compress your files before you do that. You know,
that's
put them in
true.
A zip file. That'll help save you on space there. But there are a lot of different options for you to do.
Yeah.
And those are just a few of them. But that is all the time that we have for today. Thanks for all of your questions, and keep them coming. It's questions@deemable.com. And give us a call. Like I said, we love the voicemails. Leave us a voicemail at 904-372-3336. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a good review if you enjoyed it. And if you didn't enjoy it, still leave us a good review. We won't tell anybody. Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And this is Deemable Tech. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Support for Deemable Tech is provided by A Small Orange Homegrown Hosting, a refreshingly different approach to web hosting, on the web at asmallorange.com, and by A Edelson LLC, Simple Green Technology Consulting, on the web at aedelson.com. And by Jack's Computer Guys, providing desktop and laptop service for all of Northeast Florida, on the web at jackscomputerguys.com.